With Lee Morris vacating his leadership role in the Manx Wildlife Trust earlier this year, Graham Makepeace Warne took over as CEO. So why does the Isle of Man need a wildlife trust and what does it support? I caught up with Graham earlier this week on a damp and windy winter's morning.
Chief Executive Officer of the Manx Wildlife Trust. Have you got used to the title yet?
I was just thinking, actually, I'm not used to that title yet. I tend to use CEO, so when you say it in full like that, it still just catches me off guard slightly.
And it's a big pair of shoes or wellies to fill. Lee Morris was doing a cracking job as CEO. I'll use CEO to make you feel more comfortable. What are the first things that you do when you take over from someone?
Well, firstly, hugely grateful to Lee. It was a big benefit for me to work alongside him since he started. I was actually involved with his recruitment 5 years ago, and he was a really good mentor for me. It's also fantastic that he's still with the Wildlife Trust, so he's gone on to be Director of International with the Wildlife Trust, and I'm working with him on because obviously that includes the Isle of Man, and as a UK overseas territory, it's hugely important that we look at that reach of the Wildlife Trust Federation and what we can do globally. So Lee did a fantastic job at Manx Wildlife Trust. He's really helped to build the organisation. It's a great time for me to be able to take over and continue that momentum.
And as CEO, I mean, I suppose what you wouldn't want to do is make big changes right from the word go.
No, I didn't. I am planning to stick around. I'm on a long-term trajectory with Manx Wildlife Trust, so I don't feel the need to make changes quickly. I was also involved in the last iteration of the strategy that we worked on, so I'm already very much aligned with both the Wildlife Trust Federation strategy, but also Manx Wildlife Trust strategy and our delivery plan. So there is no need to come in and make any wholesale changes straight away.
And the strategy then, let's go on to that. Maybe start with first principles. Why do we need wildlife trusts? The wildlife seems to manage quite okay so long as we leave it alone. Why do we need wildlife trusts to assist?
I suppose the quick and flippant answer to that is because we don't leave it alone. With all of this, we need to think of ourselves as part of nature. It's not about people and nature trying to get along side by side. We're all part and parcel of the same thing. And there is so much that we don't understand about the interaction between people and nature, how important nature is to us in terms of our physical and mental well-being. We live in nature. We might think we live separately in cities and towns, but we don't. We need to think of these things, blurring those lines between what is nature, what is a human landscape. It's all one and the same in my mind. And so there is definitely a need for organisations like the Wildlife Trust. We cannot rely on governments because they don't have the resourcing to focus on these things. We can look at the bigger picture stuff, and we are working with scientists to work out exactly how important nature is to our survival as a species and the planet's survival as our biosphere. So there's a lot of work for organisations like Wildlife Trust to do, and being part of that Federation of Wildlife Trust for Manx Wildlife Trust is really useful because it gives us access to that latest data and thinking about how best to do this.
You mentioned earlier that people in towns and cities, we've got two now, haven't we, Peel and Douglas, they might think that they're not connected to wildlife, but I suppose anyone who's been woken up by gulls, herring gulls in the towns and cities will realise that that's not the case. But even things like gulls, when I was young, they were everywhere. But they're now starting to become a little bit endangered, aren't they?
A lot endangered, red listed species. And people will say, why are they red listed species? I see loads of gulls. And the fact is, I love it when people mention gulls to me, because this is a really key story that people should be aware of. The gulls have just moved. So the clue's in the name. What most people refer to as seagulls is usually herring gulls. Herring gulls because they used to eat herring. what do? We came along, we fished all the herring out of the sea. So the gulls went, well, okay, there's no food there now. We're going to go inland, and we found these open landfill sites where there's lots of food waste, and we'll eat that. Great. And then we decided, quite rightly, that waste was blowing out of these landfills and we needed to cap them and stop that. So that closed off that food source. So then the herring gulls have moved into towns and cities, and they're feeding off our waste from takeaways, you know, food waste from restaurants and takeaways and that sort of thing. So all we've done is move them around. So we feel like there's lots of herring gulls because they've moved into towns, because they will nest where the food supply is. And actually, their numbers have massively dropped. So in my lifetime, I'm nearly 50, they've dropped something like 80, nearly 90%.
And that is quite shocking, really, particularly, you know, when it's the sort of thing that was everywhere. By most birds, when I was young working on the farm, skylarks were there. There were all kinds of birds that you would hear and see. You know, you're out in the hay meadows, baling hay and things. Particularly that time of the year, you would notice them. But most of these birds are now becoming much rarer.
Absolutely, and farmland birds is a key focus for us. So we have Rob Fisher, our farmland birds officer, and he's working with our Agri-Environment Scheme officer, Katie, and our farmland advisory officer, Chloe, to really get out there, find what's left. And I use that term deliberately, because it is a massive reduction in what we had. We've already lost the yellowhammer. We know our curlew numbers are very low. All these other barn owls, farmland bird species that are iconic, really important to us as an island, and we're on the verge of losing them. And the problem is that things like curlew, so their traditional method of protection, if you like, is to flock. To go, when a predator comes along, they will go up in numbers and confuse the predator and take them away from the nest sites. Now we only have one or two curlew here and there. They can't do that. And curlew are also very long-lived, so that confuses our picture of what's going on. So we think they're still hanging on, but the reality is that they're not breeding successfully. It's just that the pairs that we have on island are quite long lived, so they're getting older and older, but not successfully breeding. So these are real concerns that we have to go out, get the science, get the knowledge, and then do something about that. Now, we've increased our land ownings a lot recently, but not enough to be able to save a species like curlew. To do that, we need to work with others. We need to work with our farmers and our other landowners who have these important bits of habitat that keeps these species going.
And it is, because I think sometimes with the likes of climate change, people get a little, they're happy to believe the peddlers of the alternative facts, where basically they're told, actually, we don't need to change everything. This is just a thing much bigger than human interaction, so we can just crack on. The thing about, certainly with birds, you know, I'm not a young man, but I'm not an old man either. And in my lifetime, I've seen this dramatic change. Now that's something everyone can see, and we can absolutely understand what that's down to. That's down to changes in agricultural practice, because again, when I was a young fella, there were probably hundreds more farmers. Farming was much less intensive than it is now.
Yeah, I think we're lucky in the Isle of Man that we still have relatively traditional farming practices. We've not had the intensification that we've seen in the UK, and that has helped some species to cling on quite well. So chough, I mean, the Isle of Man, you know, is a real epicenter for chough population, something like 25% of the British Isles and Islands population. And I know when I'm across, because I come from across, you know, birders there would be absolutely delighted to see something like a chough or a hen harrier. It's easy in the Isle of Man, relatively speaking. And chough specifically, to go back to your point, is really about our traditional farming practices around the coastlines, that close cropped grazed grassland in coastal locations is what chough really, really love. A few dilapidated buildings to nest in is nice as well. So there are some real advantages in the Isle of Man, but we need to be understanding the science behind that. We need to be aware of it so that we can protect those things and not go down the same path as they have in the UK with over-intensification of farming.
I suppose the listener will be wondering what that strange windy sound, maybe it's hopefully louder to our ears than it is to the listener. So maybe we should explain where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is MWT Ballacurry Nature Reserve down near Port Erin, a really wonderful site that was gifted to Manx Wildlife Trust. It is completely run by a group of volunteers. So Trisha, our reserves manager, does a management plan for the site, but then she leaves it up to the volunteers, the Ballacurry Bashers, as we call them, to come in and have their work sessions to maintain the site. It's a really interesting site. It's a good wetland area. We've recently put an additional pond for dragonflies, which within a year had good numbers of dragonflies there. And we've recently also dug out the main pond in front of the bird hide with diggers. And that is necessary with any pond, as you'll know. It just wants to grow out. The plant species that get into ponds, they just grow and grow and grow. So unless we get in there and pull those out occasionally and maintain it, we're going to lose that water space. And it is that water habitat that's so important to so many species. And this is one of the few places that you can see some really interesting species like reed warbler and stuff like that.
And anyone who needs proof of what you're saying about ponds growing out, they just need to go down to the Curragh, which used to have significant bodies of water in it, and gradually over a century or more, it's been drained, and the sallies have grown into what used to be the ponds, and they've dried up.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So the Curragh is our island's only Ramsar site at the moment, so that's internationally important wetland site. It is, as you say, suffering from a couple of things. So the sallies or the willow trees are pulling that moisture out and growing, but also the surrounding farmland, and I don't blame anyone for this. This is just the way things have been done over the years. The idea is to put drainage ditches in to drain land so that you can farm it. You know, nobody wants muddy gateways and big areas of water in the middle of their field. So they keep their ditches clean. They dig them slightly deeper every year when they clean them out. And that is just draining water away from the Curragh, which is traditionally, a wetland site.
Farming, of course, is a really important industry. Well, it's important wherever you go in the world, really. It's perhaps not seen as important in the Isle of Man as maybe it was two or three generations ago. But we still need to grow food. Is it possible for us to have a highly productive agricultural industry that can work well with wildlife?
It's definitely possible, because it's where we started out, in the agricultural revolution, where we first started tending the land to grow crops for ourselves and to look after livestock. Still worked very much in balance with wildlife, and those practices have actually given us some of our best wildlife habitats that we have today. Take MWT Close Southfield Nature Reserve, purportedly the largest collection of wild orchids in Europe, is down to its traditional management for horse grazing. Coppicing as well is a human intervention which creates great habitat for wildlife. So it is absolutely possible, to answer your question. It does require a change in mindset, not by farmers, but by us, by people, the consumer, and how we buy food and our relationship with food. We need to get away from the idea that food is something that comes in a plastic packet from Tesco's. We should all go to our local farms and see how food is produced, support our local farm shops, get involved. When I grew up, I used to go and help the local farmer when it was baling time with the hay. It's something to do. Get out there and see, visit shops like Brian Radcliffe's Bryrads in Ramsey, where he's growing food in the ground. You can go and buy that food. Yes, it's going to be a long way off before we can provide enough food to feed the island locally, but that is what we should be aiming for. And we as Manx Wildlife Trust, we need to work with the likes of MNFU and farmers through the Agri-Environment Scheme and DEFA to make that a reality. It's not going to happen overnight. But as I say, I'll say it again, it requires a change in mindset from every consumer on the island.
And the farmers, of course, on the whole, really value the wildlife. In fact, many farmers will tell you, you know, we're not doing this for the money, because there are some farmers that do okay out of farming, but many of them are probably working for a minimum wage, and they do it because they've inherited their farms and they've inherited a lifestyle, and they actually quite like the wildlife that surrounds them.
I think you have to differentiate between landowners and farmers. So I'm talking specifically about farmers. These are people who work the land on a daily basis. And yes, absolutely, you know, nature, wildlife, habitats is where they work. That's their office. And you know, as a human being, you can't help but have some level of interest in the wildlife that's going on around you. And this is something that's been borne out through our work with the Agri-Environment Scheme, which is a contract that we run for DEFA. Going into these farms, you know, they're telling us about areas and habitats and species that they know are special on their land, which they wouldn't traditionally be prepared to do because they'd be worried about, you know, a designation being put on that site and them not being able to farm it anymore. The point is, for us as the delivery partner for the Agri-Environment Scheme, if that habitat or that wildlife is there now, then we don't want to change anything. We want them to carry on doing what they're doing. We just want to make sure that the public money for public goods is finding its way to the people who are doing those things and providing those habitats, because it's not just about protecting the wildlife, it's protecting people as well through our food supply and the green spaces that we can enjoy.
And it's often relatively small things that can be done on farms, possibly not affecting the main body of the land that the farmers rely on to produce the food, but some of the marginal bits of land are some of the easiest bits that they can, with advice from organisations such as yours, they can hand over to a greater extent to wildlife.
Absolutely. So the best example is the farm dub, the farmland pond. So traditionally, in the 1800s, there would have been hundreds and hundreds of these dubs across the island, because that was where livestock was watered. That's where they went to get their water supply. That's been replaced by mains, water systems, troughs and fields. So the dubs have lost their usefulness to agriculture, and therefore they've got filled in. They've been used in other ways. Typically, through the Agri-Environment Scheme, we see that a lot of these dubs were in the damp corners of fields, and they're still, you know, very much that way. They're difficult to farm. And so, as you say, they tend to be the marginalised bits of land around farms. Turning those back into wetland sites, into dubs, is hugely beneficial to wildlife, but that has a knock-on effect for the farm as well. And traditionally, the Agri-Environment Scheme would support those sort of things as well, but we have to make it easier for people. For example, a scrape, which is an unlined pond, so you would just go in with a digger and scrape the topsoil away to create a wetland site that might only be wet in the winter, it might dry out in the summer. It's up to planning whether or not they need to actually give planning approval for something like that. It's at their discretion. Currently, they're deciding in 100% of cases that they do. Now, that's an additional cost and time and pressure for that farmer to go through that process. And there's no reason for it. You know, the water, it's generally sites on farms that are unseen from neighbours or from the road. There's no risk of that water, you know, bursting and going anywhere else, because it's just a scrape. It just soaks away. It disappears in the summer. But it provides such important habitat for wildlife. Those muddy margins around those scrapes is so important for wading birds and other species. And again, as I say, that has a knock-on effect to the farm as well, in terms of promoting the invertebrates that pollinate our crops, and birds that control pest species as well.
And it just dawned on me, we were talking about where we are, which is the Ballacurry Nature Reserve, but we haven't described the building that we're sitting in, because of course it's a typical mizzly, drizzly sort of a day out there today. And whereas I wouldn't mind getting a little bit of dampness on me, I think the recording equipment might not be so keen. So what are we sitting in?
So this is a bird hide which was built and is maintained by the Ballacurry Bashers, the volunteers. And these are really important. We understand, you know, we want people to engage with wildlife, because people only care about what they know and understand. And we want people to come out into nature, but not get cold and wet and miserable, because that doesn't help anyone. They're going to go home with a pretty negative idea of what it's like to spend time in nature. So these sort of bird hides are really, really important. A place to sit quietly. I don't get to do this enough, so I'm really grateful that we're able to do this interview in here today. It's important to make time to come and spend a little while in these sorts of places and just enjoy what nature has to offer. And birds, you know, as everyone knows, are a relatively timid species, so bird hides just allow us to watch wildlife without disturbing them.
And actually, it is quite nice. I mean, it was even nice, I have to say, when I did Lee Morris's farewell interview. It was a hot, sunny day, and we were up in the hills. But it is nice going out into nature at this time of the year, if you've got a reasonable coat on, and seeing the difference, the change in the environment that comes as the nights draw. You become much longer and the days much shorter.
There's no such thing as the wrong weather, just the wrong kit, I think would be my advice. It's worth investing in some decent wet weather gear and just going out and enjoying the Isle of Man. The Isle of Man does have wet weather. That's why we've got the Manx Rainforest Scheme. You know, we're restoring a huge area of Manx Rainforest, temperate rainforest here in the Isle of Man, and that's because we have this wet, temperate climate. But that's not a reason not to enjoy it. We just need the right kit to go out there and spend time.
Well, we'll talk a bit more after the break. I'm hearing some birds in the background as we're talking, so I will ask you to maybe have a go at identifying some of them if you're up to that.
We can have a go. I've got Merlin on my phone to help me out.
Had a little break. I mean, there aren't many birds, it's fair to say, are there?
Well, even the Merlin app has come up empty. There's not much going on. But I was just saying, wildlife is a bit like us. It doesn't like miserable weather either. It likes to come out when the rain stops. So, yeah. I've seen a robin.
Yeah. And you reckon you heard a starling, did you?
Yeah, so starlings are mimics. So when they're usually around in groups, but when you start hearing them, it can be quite confusing because they mimic all sorts of different birds. So we have at my home, we have a nest box, a starling nest box with a camera in that is a live feed to the MWT website. And about 4 years ago, starlings moved in there, and there was a male and female. And the female was there on the nest, and the male came in courting her to anthropomorphise the situation a little bit. But he basically, for about 20 minutes, sang a song to her, tapping his feet on the nest box to create a rhythm and mimicking all sorts of different birds. The video's on our website, and you can identify, I think, up to 12 different species that he mimics, including curlew, collared dove, wood pigeon, herring gull, all these different birds that he mimics absolutely perfectly. And they've bred for 4 or 5 years now successfully. But it does annoy me because I'll often hear him mimicking a curlew, and I go, "Oh, there's a curlew nearby," and then I have to go, "No, it's probably just the starling."
And it's probably a good thing then that the starling knows how to mimic a curlew, because he's obviously hearing them.
That's exactly what I took from it. So all these species, he's not heard them. And there is examples elsewhere in the world where starlings and other birds are mimicking things like chainsaws in woodland and that sort of thing. So for that starling to be mimicking these birds, as you say, he must have heard them somewhere. So that is a good sign.
And why do they do that? Because it seems like a strange thing. I mean, if you're capable of mimicking these birds, surely you're capable of making up your own songs. Although I suppose, you know, if we think of the Beatles, they
picked up from other birds. So I think to appeal to the young listeners out there, I'd describe it as a remix.
Great. Yeah. And it is, I mean, it's just tremendous, really, to know. I mean, I didn't know that about starlings, I have to say. And again, starlings, they used to be everywhere, but there's fewer and fewer of them.
Starling's one of those species. I grew up in Manchester, and I remember, you know, starling was a species that I'd see in McDonald's car park, you know, feeding from the discarded waste from people. And it's easy to discard them as, you know, much like pigeons, as you know, just a sort of a feral species that aren't particularly interesting. But I would defy anyone to spend a bit of time looking closely at starlings in sunlight if you can, because they have the most beautiful iridescent feathers, this oily sheen across their backs. We've already talked about, you know, their song remixing skills. They are beautiful birds, and never better than when they're in number. And we are starting to see this as their numbers are recovering slightly on Ireland now, when they murmurate, when they come together. And, you know, we still don't fully understand how they do it, but they all fly in formation, creating these incredible shapes in the sky. You can sometimes see it over Peel. We believe it's to do with confusing predators, but we don't really know. What we do know is it looks amazing. And so I defy anyone to look at something like that and think that the starling is a boring species.
Another species that's not boring, that we probably wouldn't see as far south as Ballacurry in Russian, I'll correct you, you did say near Port Erin. Well, it is near Port Erin, but it's in Russian, the parish of Russian. And whereas I may be retiring as clerk to Arbury and Russian parishes soon, I will continue to fight for the parishes. But yes, a species, an exotic species that you wouldn't possibly see quite as far south here, is a wallaby, of course.
Yes. yeah, wallabies are interesting, aren't they? Clearly invasive, clearly problematic. They've been on Ireland a lot in wild habitats for a long time now, since the 60s and 70s. They seem to do relatively well for themselves, although they do suffer from inbreeding, and there is a lot of mortality in the winter. And this is something that Manx Wildlife Trust just wants to raise awareness of. It's not for us to try and come up with a solution, or indeed do we have the resourcing to fix the problem, but we just want to raise awareness of it so that government and other stakeholders can get together and decide on a management plan for them.
Because invasive species can cause huge problems. I know there were several people at different times when I was agriculture minister, both in the old DAF and then latterly in DEFA, there were several people who thought that it would be a good idea to introduce red squirrels to the island. Why isn't that a good idea?
We did a lot of work in this, and it was backed up before my time, I might add, and it was backed up by the IUCN. There is no conservation advantage to introducing red squirrels to the Isle of Man. So why is that? Well, firstly, red squirrels globally are not endangered. They're actually perfectly healthy populations around the world. Okay, they're not doing so well in England, but they are doing well elsewhere. So it's not like they need saving. The second reason is because any species, no matter how benign or cute and fluffy that species might seem, can have a detrimental impact, certainly on small, fragile island ecosystems like ours. So red squirrels do eat birds' eggs. They do strip the bark from trees like grey squirrels do. So we would have to be absolutely certain about introducing a species like that, and there just isn't the reason to do it. There are species that we could consider introducing that are native. There's no historical record of red squirrels on island, by the way. So, you know, we might look at things like a bird like the dipper, you know, as a potential reintroduction program. But even then, we would need to look very carefully at why that species has died out here in the first place. Have we recovered the habitat that they need? Have we removed the pressure that forced them out in the first place? Then and only then should we consider whether it's a good idea to bring something like that back. And in most cases, it would come back naturally. You know, certainly things like red kites, buzzards, which have only really come into the island in the last sort of 20 years or so, and are doing really well because we don't have foxes. So there's lots of carrion around for them to come and feed on. And there will be those who don't like buzzards because, you know, that they might cause issues for lambs and that sort of thing. It's all fixed by having even greater biodiversity. It's all about getting the balance right. But to go back to my previous point, we really want the habitats here to be right, the pressures removed, and for wildlife to find its own way here if it can.
And of course, one of the likely outcomes of a warming world is that some species will choose to migrate northwards because it's getting a little bit too hot for them in the south.
Yes, absolutely. It's entirely possible that our biodiversity might actually increase as a result of climate change. Now, that might on the face of it sound like a good thing, but I can guarantee it won't be. So birds especially, we're already getting more regular visits from species like hoopoe and we're getting bee eaters into the south of the UK and they will work their way north. And that's fine. The problem is more likely to be in the invertebrate species. So we've already had problems with bark beetles and bacteria and fungi that are moving north with warming climate. Ash dieback is a result of that, so we're losing all our ash trees. Dutch elm disease is a result of that, so we're losing all our Dutch elm trees. Hugely sad, hugely damaging for a native habitat like ours. There's not much we can do about that other than try and reduce the impacts of climate change and the rate of climate change. There is now, there's probably always been, but there is an oak bark beetle in Japan that will do the same to our native oak trees as has happened to ash trees. That is hugely worrying. They're not here yet, but it's something we need to keep an eye on, and that is not helped by climate change.
I mean, you said they're all ash trees. Are some of the ash trees not resistant, or...?
There is some resistance and it is improving. So the initial figures were something like 0.2%, 0.5%. I believe it's increasing now. So there is some natural resistance to it. And they will ultimately, bounce back given time and space to do that. But right now, 99% mortality rate. You drive through somewhere like Sulby Glen and, I describe it as Death Valley of ash trees. It's pretty horrific to see.
And it's actually... demonstrates just how big a deal some of these diseases can be, because it's very, very obvious now how many ash trees we used to have on the island, because there are loads of them, huge percentage of them are demonstrating that they're not long for the world.
Yeah, traditionally known as the weed of trees because they self-propagate so well, but they're hugely important to wildlife. Sycamore is probably going to replace them as the weed of trees, if you like, which is a shame because we then lose a bit of that diversity. Going back to your original point, invasive species is such an important subject because I think a lot of people don't really understand what invasive species are. So you say invasive species and you think of things like wallaby, but actually the bit that people probably have more direct link to is the plants that they use in their garden. And so one of the biggest invasive species that we have to deal with on our reserves are garden plants like Monbretia, rhododendron, Griselinia, these are species that are great in our gardens, there's no problem with that, but are not great in our wild environments, and so we spend a lot of time removing those species. Griselinia is quite a relatively recent, it's a New Zealand bush, it's great for hedging, but it's of absolutely no use to wildlife whatsoever. If you have a Griselinia bush at home, go and have a look at it in the middle of summer, and then look at a hawthorn, and you will see there's absolutely nothing feeding on or living in the Griselinia bush, but there will be lots and lots of things feeding on and living in that hawthorn bush.
And of course the other environment that we haven't really touched on at all yet is the marine environment, and whereas the sea actually acts as a barrier to land-based or some land-based species moving northwards into the Isle of Man, the sea of course provides a great means of travel.
Absolutely. 85% of our territory, we're an island, so the sea is hugely important to us and the work that we do. Our Marine Officer Lara, Dr. Lara Howe, does an amazing job. We've, since 2010, been working with government on the creation of marine nature reserves, which is actually quite good for the island. If we're able to make the Irish Sea mud bank, which is currently closed to trawling, if we can make that permanent, that actually delivers on 30 by 30, so 30% of our land and waters protected for nature by 2030. That would deliver on our marine aspect of that promise in its own right. right. So hugely worthwhile cause to go for. What I love about our marine nature reserves is when they first were created, the Ramsey one in 2010, the dredging industry understandably were concerned because they were being expelled from these sites. They weren't allowed to dredge them, which is effectively ploughing the seafloor. It's even more damaging than what we think of as terrestrial ploughing. Now the fishermen are the biggest supporters of the marine nature reserves because they can catch more scallops in less time running along the edges of the marine nature reserves because the MNRs act as a nursery and the overspill from those sites gives them a viable and sustainable stock to work from. When we get to that point, as a wildlife trust, we can step away because the fishermen will protect that marine nature reserve.
Which is, of course, a great thing. And I still remember the first absolute evidence arriving from Bangor University. They did a trial that demonstrated that the closed area in Port Erin was seeding the whole of the south and west scallop ground. And as soon as the fishermen, I mean, they kind of knew through custom and practice, you know, the fact that there were lots of scallops near the Port Erin closed area, but once the evidence was there and it was incontrovertible evidence, it became so much easier as in the old DAF and then latterly in DEFA to persuade fishermen that actually, yes, this is a good idea.
Natural solutions. And there's loads of examples. So you mentioned climate change before, and we're worried about sea level rise, increased storms, certainly the northwestern sandy coast, you know, getting washed away. Kurt Michael is a good example. Seagrass meadows and kelp forests are really good at taking the energy out of waves. Perfectly natural solution. We used to have a lot of seagrass meadows around the Isle of Man. If we can reintroduce those and provide the conditions for them to thrive again, that will take a lot of that power out of the energy out of the sea and reduce the impact of climate change and sea level rise on the island.
And in effect, it's like planting marram grass on sand dunes, isn't it? Only you're doing it in the sea to reduce that power.
Yeah, as I say, it's just a really obvious natural solution. It's something, as an island, I think we need to focus more on because ultimately it will save us money. This isn't something that's going to cost the island to do. It's a natural solution that, yes, in the short term will cost a bit of money, but in the long term it will save and it will help the island.
So actually, the next time you're driving along after a big storm and you're seeing a load of wrack on the road, it's probably not a bad thing that the rack's there, because there would have been more stone and more water on the road if the kelp, as you say, the kelp forests weren't there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can provide all this wonderful advice and support to volunteers and to farmers who and fishermen who want to change their practices and make their places more friendly to wildlife, but you can only do that if you can afford to pay your staff.
Absolutely, and having spent 8 years with the organisation already, I'm keenly aware that we rely very heavily on donations, altruism, philanthropy, which is great, but we do have a number of team members who are on short-term contracts because that's how long the funding lasts, and it's not a great way to organise an organisation the size of Manx Wildlife Trust. So what I would like to do is move the organisation towards a sustainable income stream to create that core funding that will help us deliver the work that we do. And the way that I want to do that is to realise the value of the natural solutions that I've already spoken about. So, you know, nature has a lot of value. The obvious one that people might have heard of is high integrity carbon credit scheme. So we've got a pilot project in Crossags, part of the Hairpin Woodland Park project in Ramsey, where we're planting native deciduous woodland that is great for biodiversity but is also sequestering carbon. And so to do that, we got a green preferential loan from Lloyds Bank. We bought the land, we're planting the trees at the moment. I was there yesterday with Rotary Club of Douglas putting trees in the ground, which is always a nice thing to do. And that is, as they grow, sequestering carbon, so we can sell those carbon credits to companies who have done everything they can to reduce their carbon footprint footprint, but there's always going to be that bit that you can't get rid of, and so you cover that by buying carbon credits. And we're providing those carbon credits high integrity because they're good for biodiversity as well. And that is creating a little industry, a little economy that can help the island, but it can also help MWT to create that sustainable income stream. There are lots of other examples which we're not getting up and running yet on island. So from that side of things, we are getting a nature finance officer who's going to start in January on a one-year post to write a carbon code for the island and to work with government and other stakeholders to create that industry for the island, to create that income stream. But there's also biodiversity net gain, which is in law in the UK. It was supposed to come into law in the Isle of Man at the beginning of this year, January 2025, and hasn't done yet. And that will mean that any development on island will need to be net positive for nature, i.e. It will need to recreate any biodiversity that it removes through the development of that building or whatever it might be. It makes such sense when you hear it in those terms, but I understand there's complex legislation that has to go behind that. But it's so important that we push that forward as an island, because one, it protects our island, it protects the habitat and environment, but two, it will help organisations like Manx Wildlife Trust, and it's not just us that will benefit from this, but it helps organisations like us create a sustainable income stream to help us plan better for the future.
And I suppose people, well, some of the concerns at least surrounding that whole biodiversity net gain, gosh, it's really starting to blow now. The pond have got more than ripples on it just at the moment. But yeah, the biodiversity net gain, because it's new, I suppose, people will be a little bit concerned and wondering how this is actually going to work. From a developer's point of view, obviously it's going to add a little bit of cost to the development, most likely, particularly on large developments, it will add some cost. But presumably for landowners, the biodiversity net gain element can be transferred to other land, not necessarily associated directly with the site, or how does it actually work?
It can be transferred. Obviously, local is important. It should be as close to the site as possible. Just to go back to your previous point, yes, it does add a bit of cost to the development, but nobody wants to buy houses that has no nature around them. You know, we need to get to a point where developments aren't just about houses for people. It's about enabling people and nature to live side by side. As I said at the beginning of this interview, people are part of nature. And so actually, if you do developments like that, the negative impact on biodiversity is much less anyway. But also those people living in those properties, because of the advantages that they will get to their health, their family's health, their mental well-being, are willing to pay a little bit more for it. And developers know that. So we're already working with the likes of Hartford Home, who are doing BNG in some instances voluntarily. We need to make sure that everyone's doing it so it's a level playing field. So it needs to come into legislation. But people are already doing this, and it's working quite successfully in the UK.
And you've referenced a couple of times during this programme the kind of mental well-being that people get from being able to see green things.
It's huge, and I think we all know it deep down. There was a study in Yorkshire that found that every £1 spent on parks and green spaces saved the local NHS £34. Now, I'm not saying we need to reduce DHSC's budget, to pay for that. Clearly, it doesn't happen overnight. But we need to start looking at dealing with the cause of our poor health rather than the symptoms. And we know, even if we don't fully understand the science, we know that spending time in nature is good for us. Recent studies have shown that spending time in nature actually increases the amount of grey matter in our prefrontal cortex. I take that to mean it makes us smarter. What business doesn't want their staff to be smarter? So businesses now want to be in green places. I was recently in Paris looking at some of the work that the mayor, Hidalgo, has been doing there to basically green the city of Paris. And it's amazing what they're doing there. So she without going into this in too much detail, she started off by ripping up a couple of roads, stopping cars from using them, putting trees and green streets in. as you'd expect, there was a little bit of backlash to begin with. So she ran a referendum and she won that referendum by 55%. Then at the next general election for Paris, her opposition tried to compete on the grounds of ripping up the green streets and letting the cars back in. But by that time, people had got used to them. They liked them. They didn't want to lose them. So she got a double mandate to carry on doing that. And now in Paris, if you want to refurbish a building or develop a new building, you have to commit to at least 60% green roof or green wall. And they're not just talking about a sedum roof like on the top of this bird hide. They mean trees, bushes, plants, that sort of thing. So now if you haven't been to Paris for a while, go and have a look around. Every other building has greenery on it somewhere. And they've got these wonderful parks and green spaces. Now, they did this in the typical French way. They started out without knowing how they were going to fund it. But what they're finding now is the businesses are moving back into Paris because they've got the double advantage of having the handy location of being in a city where there's public transport, but also those green spaces that make their employees happier and smarter.
And you can now effectively clothe your building with greenery, can't you? I mean, it's not just the roof or the ground that surrounds the building. You can actually add green walls to your buildings.
Yep, hydroponics, green walls. There's all sorts of different ways to do it. And, you know, I know you love a bit of tradition, but if you look back at how we used to do things, we would have ivy growing up the side of buildings. You know, it wasn't that's a building just for people to live in, that's for nature over there in that nature reserve. It was all part and parcel of the same thing. And yes, it takes a bit of maintenance, but it makes a much, as I said, it's not just about supporting wildlife, it's creating a place where we all want to live and work.
Do you think in the, I suppose, polarised world that where we appear to be living in at the moment, that the argument can be won for wildlife?
I think so. It's so important to us. As I say, deep down, I think we all know it. We can't live without wildlife. We are part of nature. So it's all or nothing. Biosphere, you know, I sit on the Biosphere board, and I think the way that MWT and Biosphere really align is about a desire and a drive for people and nature to thrive together, because really, that's the only solution. And I think we can do it, but it's going to take a lot of collaboration. We need to work with partners, stakeholders, government, organisations, people to make this happen.
Because, of course, we hear a lot about climate change, and it would appear that global efforts to tackle climate change, if not stalled, they seem to have shifted down a gear. But there's also biodiversity loss, which is seen as an equally concerning issue.
It's all part and parcel of the same story for me. So biodiversity loss and climate change are absolutely linked. So they need to be looked at together. If you look at what the greatest risk to wildlife is, if you go 50 years into the future, it will be climate change. Now, we need to look at ways that we can prevent that from getting any worse than it already is, and trying to limit the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. And we need to look at ways that we can do that. Now, any development will have impact on wildlife, and we need to try and minimise that as much as we can. It's getting that balance right. But if we don't do anything, then it's not a good outcome for either people or wildlife.
And of course, nature can find some of the solutions itself to this.
Absolutely. As I've mentioned a couple of times already, natural solutions should always be our first port of call. It's probably going to be the cheapest and easiest way to achieve something. Look at what natural solutions are out there. We've talked a little bit already about sea level rise and you know, what it can do to stop overtopping. But also, you know, if you look at the work that we're doing on our Manx rainforest restoration sites, I had quite an interesting meeting with the Chief Minister about Glen Aldin, and he said, you know, what are you planning to do there? I said, well, we're planting temperate rainforest, planting trees. And he said, will that increase the risk of flooding? And I can understand why someone might think that might be the case, but it's absolutely the opposite. Trees will prevent flooding. They dry the ground out. They slow the water movement down, and that will stop flooding downstream. So, you know, Laxey Valley, other valleys around the island really need to be wooded to help prevent those sorts of issues that we're already struggling with, you know, from a cost perspective, from not being able to get insurance. Nature has the solution. We just need to work with it.
We're almost out of time now, so I'm going to ask you in a probably a minute or so to summarise where you think the trust's going to be in 5 or 10 years' time?
Wow, I'll try and limit it to 1 minute. I think we're on a good trajectory. As I say, I think collaboration is key to where we go from here. I think being able to find the financial value of natural solutions to help support Manx Wildlife Trust and our work going forward is going to be really, really important. I would like in 5, 10 years' time to see us managing more land for nature, working with government and people even more for the benefit of all.
That was Graham Makepeace-Warne, CEO of the Manx Wildlife Trust. So what do you think? Should we be doing more to support Manx wildlife? Have you noticed the significant drop in insects and birds in the Isle of Man recently? Perhaps you think wildlife will find its own way to survive and we should just leave it to fend for itself. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast. I'm Phil Gorn, Gurra Mayo and Geisteachrum. Thanks for listening.